Welcome to Clarity Fun Podcast. This is episode 12, and I'm joined again by Dr. Kelly Burton.
Hello.
This is Dr. Owen Anderson, and we're looking at and been discussing mentoring young philosophers. Both Dr. Burton and I work in and have been in the Secular Academy for our whole careers. And so we're thinking about that as we look back on that. What would we have told our young selves, or when we're asked questions by younger students who might sometimes feel perplexed? This is a, can we say this is a guide to the perplexed?
Yes.
So then we'll say, well, how do we go through this? How do we make sense of it? And also, incidentally, I also get questions from parents. They might say, hey, my senior level high school student wants to go into philosophy. What do you think? So that's also somebody who I'm thinking of in our, as our audience says, yeah, what will you tell a parent about? Because that must be a kind of a low point. You can imagine my parents when they have to tell their friends who are bragging about their kids, well, what does your kid do? Oh, he's a philosopher. I'm not sure that's ever on a parent's list of what they'll brag about, right?
Depends on the parent.
Yeah, I know. I think my parents are probably happy about it. But thinking about any parent and their kid comes to them and says, I know what I want to do when I grow up. I want to be a philosopher. I say, well, have you thought of dentistry? And let's think about some other options. So what is a successful person? We've kind of been talking about that with what is a good life. And we've been looking at different features of philosophy. Philosophy as an area, philosophy as an attitude, philosophy as a method, philosophy as an application. And at the end of our previous episode, we got to philosophy as a system, where with philosophy you build, you construct a coherent world and life view. You apply your assumptions into all areas of life. So we've both talked about how we didn't think simply stopping with philosophy, especially since a lot of the philosophy we got was analytic philosophy.
Yeah.
We wanted to explore literature, history, religious studies, all the fields that we can. My books are about things like religion in America and natural law and politics. So we wanted to apply our interest into every field we could.
Right.
We've said we were interdisciplinary before it was a thing.
Yes. And going back to this philosophy as a system, and what we were talking about in the previous episode is that we use reason to construct a coherent world and life view. We answer these questions, whether consciously or unconsciously, how do I know things? What is real? What is eternal? What is the good life? We all have answers to those questions. Part of self-examination is to discover how we've answered those questions. And in the history of philosophy, philosophers answer those questions. We've been discussing this. And part of our job is to be detectives and uncover those answers and to see, are there good reasons? Now, in the history of philosophy, there have been systems that have been developed, promoted, that didn't match reality and may be the reason we have skepticism. Look, these people claim to use reason, but look at what they came up with. That's not true.
Yeah. And we can see how different philosophers were inclined towards some of the different features of philosophy we've talked about. So, for example, we've been talking a lot about Socrates, or maybe by implication, Plato, and the unexamined life, the application. We've talked about Cicero and wisdom. We think about Kant. Maybe Kant was especially concerned about critical philosophy, the critique of pure reason, the critique of practical reason. And Descartes always stands out as a critique of what we know. Hegel is a systematizer, building an entire system. And so different philosophers may lean towards one or more of these. And then if you study just that philosopher, you might just be kind of just studying that area. But we've come to system last on purpose, because system presupposes, as you build a system, you're presupposing these other things. You're presupposing answers to basic questions. And you're presupposing a whole approach to knowledge. So although we've talked about the critical use of reason, some cases someone might begin just with the senses.
Right.
And think somehow that gets them to knowledge, and then they build a whole system on just the senses.
Right. And then there's the rationalists who start with reason is how we get to truth, and then they construct a system that's very rationally coherent, but it doesn't actually match reality, so it's not actually true, and then they get in trouble later on down the line. I think this is what...
Yeah, the rationalists, especially in making predictions about the empirical world just from reason, For example, the famous is the example is the number of planets. There can only be this number of planets because there are only that many Platonic solids. And then discovering the next number, the, you know, going from, oh, no, there's not just six or seven planets. So, yeah, making those kinds of assertions, there must only be seven planets because I like that number. It fits well with other things. That's rationalism. So you and I do talk about reason, and someone might think, oh, okay, they must be rationalists. Well, no, that's not what rationalism has meant. Rationalism means this other thing. And so that's part of why I mentioned Kant. His critique of reason was a response to his earlier rationalism.
I like that you brought Kant up because I think he's going to be a piece that breaks from systems. Like, I think today, postmodern likes to think, we don't do system building. We don't do metaphysics as a system.
Yeah.
But they do. They just don't. Yeah, do that's explicitly.
Good. That's good. By talking about postmodernism, we're kind of identifying that there are historical eras.
Yes.
So someone say we're in the postmodern era, which then obviously means there was a modern era. And we could talk about pre-modern, modern, postmodern, or maybe like early modern, modern, late modern.
Yeah.
But either way, we're saying there's something that holds this time together. And so perhaps for the modern, in my books, I date the modern from 1648, the end of the wars of religion, to 1945, the end of World War II.
Yeah.
So it's on both ends, bookended with wars, mm-hmm. which bring out the inability to come to agreement. And so I think there is, interestingly, both an assertion in the modern world, some bold assertions about what, say, science can do and what the government can do, but also a kind of skepticism about other matters, especially religious matters. We just have lots of different religions, and the government is constructed to keep those religions in peace with each other, but they don't ever actually come to have knowledge.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm wondering about system, and does a system broadly hold an era together, a system of philosophy hold an era together?
Yeah, exactly. And it takes time for that system to come to expression and the inadequacies of that system to be exposed to everyone. And those are exposed through the process of being challenged.
Yeah.
So challenge comes up and you don't have a sufficient response to it, and that exposes that your presuppositions aren't accurate. And so then I said all that to get us to postmodernity.
Yeah.
So postmodernity sees that some of the bold knowledge claims of modernity failed, and pretty catastrophically, right?
Yeah.
World War II really is kind of one long war. World War I and World War II is one long war, and it's devastating. There's no doubt that that's a failure.
Yeah.
And so the postmodern world is saying something has to be done different.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Heidegger who said that all of Western philosophy leads to the Holocaust or something like that.
Yeah, so
the systems.
Yeah, the systems failed.
Yeah.
And so in that way, we can relate to the postmodern concern and say, yeah, we don't want to go that direction. But then postmodernism still has this skepticism in place.
Right.
And it may, instead of what it might think is that it's more authentic. And so it might say, well, modernism has skepticism but claim to know. We'll simply embrace that no one knows anything and the nihilism that comes with that, and instead focus on the particular.
Yeah, so when you do that, you focus on the particular, you lose reality, really, because the particular is always changing and there's no universal.
Yeah.
So what is unchanging and knowable?
Well, that's one of the reasons why some people say postmodernity is not its own era.
Yeah.
It's simply just still the outworking of the empiricism of the modern world.
That's what I was going to ask you next. Is this really an era, or is this the shaking up of of the end of that era?
Yeah, what I called it in the Natural Moral Law book is it's the skeptical age between eras.
Yeah.
So it's kind of skepticism come to fruition, and we'll see, well, it ultimately leads to only particulars, and then, yeah, you're not able to get, what happens then is individual satisfaction is the highest good, and we kind of cooperate with each other as long as we help each other get to individual satisfaction, but we'll often come into friction,
right?
Because your pursuit of individual satisfaction conflicts with my pursuit of individual satisfaction, and we're not getting to universal truths anymore.
Right. It doesn't seem to be working very well, and it seems like we're going from individual satisfaction to collective. We're going to try that next.
Yeah, well, and that's the hope, is maybe if the collective satisfaction is a kind of utilitarianism,
right,
all that matters is the most people that we can satisfy, and you'll hope you're in the most and not the few.
Yeah, and then bring the government in to make sure it works right.
Yeah, so that's where it's a continuation of the modern solution to our problems. Beginning with the wars of religion, those ended with the Peace of Westphalia. So you have the government saying, we'll keep peace between religious factions. And so you have that continuation through modernity, as the government is the one who will somehow provide us with a good life.
Yeah, we're still in that. And I'm not sure we're done with, like, the secular wars.
Yeah.
Since World War I, I think we're still in the fallout from that.
Yeah, and that's giving another plug to another one of my books. That's why I focused on the Declaration of Independence in my book, The Declaration of Independence and God, because it starts off with stating, just like in our previous episode, we talked about how Carl Sagan states his views at the very beginning of Cosmos. The Declaration of Independence does too, but I think it does it better because it starts off with epistemology. We hold these views to be self-evident. Whether they're right or wrong about that, they're at least getting to, look, there are some things that you start off with. And then it gets into metaphysics, the creator, and human nature. That's a real thing. And then the ethics, they have rights because you have this nature given to you by God. So that's a structure, I think, that's really helpful. Metaphysics, epistemology, metaphysics, ethics, as a system, which then can be challenged. And what I argued in that book is that the rest of American history is a kind of challenge about, did we get that foundation in place? But minimally, you're starting there at least. You're identifying it more consciously than others.
Okay, that's good. So you mentioned it's stated more consciously, and then you asked, did we get the foundations in place? I would say probably not, but it seems like an opportunity in history that we can be conscious of that and try to do that. Yeah. And that's why we're against skepticism, which is a roadblock to doing that.
Yeah, and that's what, because someone could say, the history of philosophy has been a catastrophic failure. And I would respond by saying, well, actually, even that so-called failure is part of what philosophy is. So what's happened is we've learned a lot of what the answer isn't.
Right.
Which is also an answer.
Right.
And so we're becoming, part of the history of philosophy is becoming more conscious, which means, okay, not that, not that, not that. I'm more aware now of the question I'm asking because I found out these are not the right answers. And so I think that's part of what postmodernity asks for, is a greater consciousness. But I always wonder if it's kind of like Smerdyakov in The Brothers Karamazov, which is Ivan, one of the brothers, likes to talk and give speeches about nihilism.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really do anything about it, though. But his half-brother puts it into action. And so later on, towards the end, there's a scene where Ivan is asking Smerdyakov about why he killed his dad. And he says, I just did what you couldn't do. And so I wonder if that's kind of how it works. There's a progression of consistency where someone who likes to talk about nihilism but then still lives if his life has meaning, and then someone else who says, you know what, if we're going to be consistent, we need to put it into practice and actually say there are only particular things, there is no universal meaning.
Right. I agree with you, and I think this is funny because I remember we had an argument over who was more consistent, Hume or Nietzsche, and I think the example is just like that. Hume says these things but then goes and plays games with his friends, whereas Nietzsche's like, no, I'm going to live this way and see what happens.
Yeah.
And then he's like the granddaddy of postmodernism.
Yeah, there's, I think, a direct line from Hume to Nietzsche to Foucault.
Yeah.
And a kind of, and what they share in common is what I think we call radical empiricism.
Yes.
To distinguish it from Lockean empiricism.
Yes.
So there are only individual experiences, is what Hume says. Even my own mind is just these individual experiences. I don't see a mind when I look inside. I just see experiences. And so then, you have that family resemblance down through Nietzsche and down to Foucault of, well, let's be consistent then and put that into practice.
Now, let me ask you, do you think that is coming to an end? Is it played out, or can we drive it a little bit harder?
Well, played out in terms of collective life, played out in terms of individual life, is part of what we'll have to look at and see, right? How much meaninglessness can an individual deal with? How much can a collective group deal with? How many different ways are there to deceive ourselves and distract ourselves? That's a well-known book, right? Driven to Distraction.
Right, yeah.
Amusing ourselves to death.
Yes.
Was the one I was thinking of. That's a good question. Like, how far can we go? How long would the postmodern in-between age last? But I wouldn't think it... I mean, I would think there's a kind of some historical patterns you can look at. You can see people turn away from it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a... let's see, this is the fourth generation after World War II, right?
I think so.
So it's kind of played out, boomers down to Z, playing out these assumptions into people's lives. And the implication is going to be that people say, no, I want a meaningful life.
Yes. So we are doing this in the context of giving advice to young people. I imagine we're speaking to the next generation. And I think we're doing this because we don't want to continue on this trajectory, the system that we see undergirding, let's say, the West. It's going to be played out. It's going to lead to meaninglessness. So we're doing this in order to maybe point in a different direction. That's what Clarity Fund is about, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's what we're working on. And that gets us to maybe instantly use another example from Brothers Karamazov, because the other brothers see what Smerdyakov did and turn away from it. They see, well, if that's the outcome of Ivan's nihilism, then I'm not going down that road. And they look elsewhere. Now, I don't think Dostoevsky is providing a philosophical answer then.
Right.
He's giving you a literary answer. So if you push that too hard, you'll say, oh, he didn't come out far enough. But I'm just using it as a literary example to say, you'll see that's not enough. I'm not going to be able to live that way.
Yeah.
There's a kind of that's why he's an existentialist. It's existentially impossible to live that way. And then we could also give ontological arguments about the nature of being. It also can't be that way, or logical arguments about the nature of thought. So nihilism is unacceptable. So what we might think about as we conclude this episode is why some things must be clear.
Yes.
I think we're proposing that's the answer to postmodern and modern skepticism.
Agree. Yes.
And the and what we've said is some things are clear. The opposite, the contradiction of that is nothing is clear. And we're not saying all things are clear.
Right.
Some things are clear, and specifically basic things are clear, because if basic things aren't clear, then the more complex things that use the basic things aren't clear either.
Yeah.
So if anything's clear, it's the basics. And the basic things are about God and man and good and evil. So you'll see that come up a lot in Clarity Fund material for that reason, that's where we begin. And the opposite is to say nothing about God and man and good and evil is clear to reason at all. Now, interestingly, I guess someone could be saying it's clear, but not to reason. It's clear some other way. But usually the ones I encounter are saying it's not clear to reason. They end up just rejecting reason.
Right. That's where you have to start, right? And clear in some other way. I'd like to see what that might mean. Oh, but if we ask what does that mean, we're still using reason.
Yeah. You'd be distinguishing it from what it isn't.
Yeah.
Using the law of identity. So, yeah, it's not possible to avoid that, and we've covered that in other places. But, yeah, starting off with some things are clear, and that's the motto. I think that's what the Declaration of Independence is doing.
Yes.
Now, they might be mistaken about this thing self-evident brings up problems, but they're starting off with this idea that, look, here's some clear things, and all the rest of what we're going to argue is built on that.
Okay, so let's bring this back to philosophy as a system. What you're proposing, what we're proposing, I guess, is that there's an alternative system. We start by saying some things are clear to reason. That's the epistemology. And the things that are clear are about God and man and good and evil. And those are the system. So when we start fleshing that out, we're building an alternative system. And we're saying, here it is. And here's our arguments. We're going to use this method of critically analyzing basic beliefs, ruling out others, to land here. And that's also part of that history of philosophy. But at least we know what doesn't accord with reality. And so we have challenges, responses, and now here's where we are in history, and this is our response to the challenges.
Yeah.
Clarity.
Yeah, and we're coming up. I think we're coming up to the current challenge,
yeah,
which is a challenge about knowledge, and that's why we've said any answer, even though it might sound like it's still a religious answer, it's reformed and it's epistemology, so it must be the answer. But any answer that ends up trying to define knowledge in the same way the skeptic is doing so isn't going to provide us with the answer to this challenge. It's just accepting the challenge. It's just accepting the outcome, which is we don't really know. And so I think you and I have both done work on that and wanted to avoid saying we can have knowledge in the same, we can know God in the same way the materialist knows other minds. And we're saying, no, we could actually know God because the alternative is impossible.
Yes.
And that's one thing that's a little bit different. I know what you mean when you say corresponds to reality, but I also, sometimes empiricists hear that one way and they'll say, yeah, we have to run a lot of tests and see if our theory matches reality.
Yeah.
And so we want to clarify, well, the first place it corresponds is if you're saying something is when it isn't, then that's not possible.
Right.
So if you're saying what's eternal also had a beginning, then this is a contradiction.
Yes.
And can't be real, can't correspond to reality. So simply beginning with that, and I think that's where we'll see answers to what is eternal. We don't need to run tests, like get in the Starship Enterprise and fly around the universe looking for God, and then say, oh, I didn't find him, so there is no God. No, we're just asking, could something which is not self-maintaining, matter, have always been there?
Right. And this is where we get back to that, really, the foundation of the foundation, the laws of thought, because that's the tool that lets us see that, no, contradictions can't both be true in the same respect at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So learning to use reason as we critically think about basic questions is going to be the answer to the challenges of our age.
Yes.
That's what we're proposing. And starting off with that fixed point, we don't want skepticism and we don't want fideism. And these two kind of form a antinomy because the skeptic will say, look, I don't want to blindly believe things. And you can relate to that. But the fideist will say, you got to believe something. And you can relate to that. And so they go back and forth. And we're proposing a break of the stalemate by bringing in another option, which is that it's clear. And here's why I think that's an uncomfortable option. If it's clear and I haven't seen it, I have to confess that.
Yes.
And what the skeptic and the fideist both do is they're able to save face by saying, I don't know and you don't know. No one knows. And then they argue about what to do about no one knowing. The fideist saying believe and the skeptic saying don't believe. And what we're proposing could be more uncomfortable.
Yes.
Here I am, an adult, and I still remember the first philosophy class I had, the very first question. So we're all young adults, we're all in college, and we're all asked, what is good? And none of us knew. And it wasn't just, for me, a point of interest, like, oh, I don't know the capital of North Dakota. I'd like to find that out. I don't know the good. I want to find that out. It was convicting because, well, we're young adults. Why don't we know these things? And so I think that's part of what comes with this is that we're going to have to confess I haven't been seeking.
Yes. I had that moment when I discovered you can know by reason. And it was very easy to see that. And it was a conviction. I should have known that all along. It was so right in my face, right before me, clear. And so I think that's where humility comes in, an attitude of being willing to recognize where you're wrong and repent, change your way.
Yeah, I was recently told, holding to reason is the height of arrogance. But I'm seeing it as just the actual opposite of that. Precisely because of my condition of not seeking, I have to humble myself and affirm reason and the authority of reason over me.
You're right. I tell my students, when I saw the authority of reason, when I saw that it can't be questioned without using it, and I wanted to question everything, I couldn't question reason, I had to submit to reason. And that was the first time I submitted to authority.
Yeah. So it's actually the opposite. I mean, the other view, which says reason is the height of arrogance, is itself arrogant, because what you're saying is my mind is above even reason.
Right.
So this is interesting what happens when we start to have twisted things get where we're not seeking. But yeah, so I think this, what we're proposing is more than just, hey, we have some nice information to teach some younger kids. But what we're saying is really philosophy begins that we should have been seeking and we weren't seeking. And then that involves, being able to humble yourself. We do see that in Socrates to some extent where he realizes I don't know, but I'm not sure even he goes far enough. I think maybe that what we talked about in a previous episode gets closer, which is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah.
And there's this realization, the fear of the Lord, this realization of, I didn't know what I should have known. I have to confess that about myself. And that's where I begin.
Yes. Going back to Socrates for a moment, it seems like one of the things he didn't have that we have the benefit of is friends that can ask you questions that could help you seek. And you need a community to do that. You need others to say, hey, you claim to know, but do you really?
Yeah, you can't go off and do this by yourself.
Right.
And so I think that's right. And I think there's a need for self-examination, but also putting yourself in the place to be examined by others.
Exactly. And I think that's another reason we're doing this, is because we're like two people in Phoenix. We have presented a bunch of challenges, but it's daunting. We need other people to sign on.
Yeah.
We need people to help us.
Yeah, it's a team effort. And there's a growth to be had, and it's kind of an exponential growth, right? The more people help, it grows not just by adding, but by exponential growth. So we're continuing our series, and let's both mention our YouTube pages, because we have a lot of videos available. What is your YouTube page?
My YouTube page is just my name, Kelly Fitzsimmons Burton, and I have a few different playlists. One's called Thinking, one's called Public Philosophy, and the other is Retrieving Reason.
And my YouTube page is Renewal Philosophy, and I have playlists, for example, Hiking with Anderson, Questions for a Philosopher, Reading with Anderson, and I'm doing some playlists on some of my books. So I do have my Amazon author page there, and I'm doing some playlists on The Natural Moral Law and on Reason and Faith at Early Princeton, and also on the book Philosophical Foundation, Critical Analysis of Basic Belief by Dr. Surendra Gangadine. So we have these resources available, and we're going to continue these podcast series on mentoring young philosophers. Thanks again for joining me, Dr. Burton.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all next time.
Take care.